Welcome back to another episode of The Action. This is still free to air. The members area is still being built. Hopefully it's ready very soon. But The Action is about an hour, give or take, maybe 15 minutes. In this particular case, it'll be probably closer to 45 minutes, where Max and I speak about what happens in the world of distance running, sometimes triathlon, but endurance running in the world. And this was actually a pretty busy week. We had Tokyo Marathon, we had World Indoors, London Marathon entries came out. Max, we're excited about all these things, but I think we can start with the Tokyo Marathon and this interesting situation with Kenyan Athletics and this big group of Kenyan runners that they need to select a team from, which there's so many guys here that have run 204 or faster.
Before we get into that, I actually just realized, I remembered from your intro that this is sometimes the triathlon podcast as well, lightly. I think we would be remiss. Let's just give a quick shout out to the athlete of one of the coaches that we have here at Sweat Elite Coaching Academy, Magnus Ditlev, the Big Dane, pulled off massive victory at the first installment of the new PTO T100 triathlon series at Miami Speedway in Florida yesterday. Heard from boots on the ground, both from his coach and Sweat Elite Coaching Academy triathlon head coach, Casper Pedersen, and Magnus's manager, my good friend, Patrick Lemieux, that conditions at Miami were almost 90 degrees Fahrenheit with humidity deep in the 80s or 85% plus humidity. Came down to a dogfight between Magnus Ditlev, Matthias Margiere, Sam Long, with Alistair Brownlee taking an early lead on the run. One of the really interesting things that Patrick told me was that basically running 325 to 330 Ks was what it took to win. Those athletes were so dusted from full gas racing on the bike in really tough conditions that I was watching the race late in the race and nobody looked good. Everyone looks terrible. Everyone looks like they're just completely slogging through. These are athletes who can typically run 305, 310 pace per K off the bike after a hard bike in one of these middle distance formats that has an 18K run, and they are just slogging through it. But it was a war of attrition, and to the victor went the spoils, and that was Magnus Ditlev. So congrats, Magnus. Congrats, India Lee, for taking the win on the women's side. But really cool racing in the triathlon space with this T100 series. And the race this weekend in Florida, was that indicates anything, it'll indicate that this series is going to be incredibly exciting. So even if you don't watch triathlon, Matt, I know you watched the race. You have any other thoughts you want to throw out?
I tuned into the race and I've watched so much triathlon recently, especially in the last 2 years, because there's so much good content, especially on YouTube. And I feel like I've gotten to know a lot of these guys. In some particular cases, I've met them and I've done some videos with them and so on and so forth. But I'm more referring to the fact that I watch a lot of their content and I've really back them. I really want, and in Magnus's case, we got super lucky that Casper, head coach of triathlon at Sweat Elite Coaching Academy, he's very good, best friends with Magnus. So we were able to do that video 2 weeks before winning. And it's so cool to be able to just see like how Magnus is preparing for this really big race, this T100 race. It's a whole other conversation that we'll have at some point about why the T100 and the triathlon is doing so well and why it's so good for the sport of triathlon and why athletics needs to look towards that and maybe come up with something similar. But there's a whole lot of dynamics to that.
You posted on your Instagram story, you posted the TV that showed the general format outline for T100, and you said, I hope Seb Coe is watching.
Yeah. I just looked at that screen and was like, they have written out 6 lines that you can read in 1 minute that lets people fully understand exactly what's going on in the season, how the points work and all that. And I think that's awesome. This podcast is focused more around running, and we're going to cover the week of running, even though we will touch on from time to time some triathlon stuff, because Max is a triathlete. We all love triathlon and we do a lot of triathlon content. But Tokyo Marathon happened. Kipchoge went down again. What do you think? Did you see that coming?
We all knew it was going to be a matter of time. It wasn't a question of if, it was a question of when. And the question that we have here is this the start of a decline or is this the start of a period of inconsistency, right? Kipchoge's career has been defined by not just great success, but consistent success, right? Other marathoners who have been at times the best marathoner in the world or one of the best marathoners in the world have bad races and we don't write them off because it's a relatively normal thing to sometimes have a bad one in the marathon, no matter how good you are. With Kipchoge, it's so rare for him to have a bad race that it's only natural for us to question if his entire career is over on the basis of one bad race. Now, I think it's important to consider that this pace, like, they, yes, he got beaten by a lot of guys and a lot of guys who went out at this pace who didn't get screwed over by it in the end, or only faded less than Elliott did. They did go out in 60-35, right? That is 2:01.10 pace. That is 1 second behind Kipchoge's personal best in the previous world record. And I think halfway 60% through the race, if Elliott runs a PR, he is going to win this race, because no one's hanging on to run 2:01. No one was hanging on to run 2:01 in Tokyo this weekend. A couple guys did run 2:02, but yeah, that's what makes this so difficult, is that he's so good that we hold him to such a high standard, and we don't really know what a bad race means. Does it mean that he still is capable of winning a gold medal in Paris, and he's still capable of running 2:02 in a fast course on the right day? Or is that never going to happen again? We have no idea. And I don't think Elliott really does either. This is uncharted territory for him. This is uncharted territory for the sport. We don't know what to expect after watching his career up to this point. So it is just going to be really interesting to see the decisions the Athletics Kenya makes. They are going to be the ones who have to place a bet, a big one, on which side of the coin that performance fell on, whether it's the hand of time reaching out to Kipchoge and pulling him down, or if it's just, obviously, no matter how you take this result, it's a result, it shows some sort of decline of Kipchoge's performance, right? But the question is whether that decline is consistent, or if it's more of a one-off. But yeah, that decision is going to be made in the minds of many running fans, but the most important people to make that decision are Athletics Kenya, as they set the team for the Paris Olympics.
It's even more of a fascinating situation because it's obviously his last run before the Olympics, and it didn't go very well at all. In fact, you would argue that's actually probably his worst marathon performance he's ever run, maybe even.
208 in London, the 208 in London was pretty bad.
He was a seventh, though, I think, there. And then the conditions that day weren't great. Although with that said, there were some pretty fast times. That's the day that Skoulian ran his PR. But
I think that's the day that Safwan Hassan also popped off in the women's race as well. So that was, or was it Safwan? Yeah, I think Safwan Hassan won.
Different
Sarah
London
Hall,
marathon.
Sorry. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was the one that Sarah Hall went really well at. Yeah. But besides the point, I think it's his worst placing in a marathon, maybe ever.
Totally. Yes. Yes.
10th. Yeah. So that's interesting. We get asked the question, everyone's asking themselves the question of, is this the end of Kipchoge? And my initial answer is, we have no idea. We don't know. Because when he went poorly in London in 2020, people thought, oh, he's over. And look what he did since then. He won the Olympics and he smashed the world record again. So who knows? Who really knows what he's going to do from here? But the question that we want to ask is, and to speculate the answer over, is who is Athletics Kenya going to send to the Olympics? Because the two top dogs that people were thinking were going to be probably going 1-2 at Paris were Kipchoge and Kiptum. That was before February. And now,
let me set this up. Yeah. Yeah. Now, rest in peace, Galvin Kiptum. And yeah, we don't know what's up with Kipchoge. But no real delicate way to say that. But what I was going to say is, I think let's start ourselves off with one quick question. Maybe not a quick question, but I think an important one. Do you think that Athletics Kenya is going to decide whether or not Kipchoge goes to Paris on the basis of what they think he is capable of, or what they think three other guys might be capable of? Because I think if I was them and I was starting out with this decision, I think you can say, look, ultimately it comes down to, do you trust Kipchoge or not, right? I think obviously, there have already been several Kenyans who have run under 2:03 in 2024. There will be probably several more. And there's going to be a ton of them who run faster than the 2:06 that Kipchoge dropped in Tokyo. So you're not going to be able to say Kipchoge is clearly better than these guys. You're going to have to be placing a bet. But no matter what, you're going to have 3, 5, 10, 12 guys who are better on paper in the year 2024 than Kipchoge is. But the question with their decision is, do they bet more on Kipchoge's potential upside, or do they bet more on others to be better? You see what I'm saying? It's a difference. There are going to be plenty of guys they could pick instead. They're not going to pick them instead because of what they've done. If they pick them instead, it's because they think Kipchoge's done, right? So they just need to ask themselves the question of, what Kipchoge's upside this summer, because there's going to be a guy we've never heard of who's going to run 2 minutes faster than him. And that doesn't necessarily mean that guy's going to make the team, right? If Kipchoge does get named to the team, he will have the lowest season best of the team by probably 4 minutes. And that's just going to be a fact. But if they make that decision, it's because they're betting on his potential upside as a guy who's run well in the heat. It's important to note that, like, the Olympic marathon is the only marathon that happens in the summer. And Kipchoge has now proven himself twice there in a way that a lot of other athletes have not. Even if they are good heat runners, we don't find that out from their spring and fall marathon performances. And we just simply don't know. Yeah, I think they just have to ask themselves, what's Kipchoge's upside? And I think that will forge the decision-making path from then as to if they leave him on the team or not.
You raised some very good questions. Ultimately, what's happened here is Athletics Kenya, they have listed 10 people that they're going to select the team from.
Provisional list.
Now, this was made weeks ago because Kelvin kicked him his on it. And what's
It was in December.
Okay. But what's most interesting is there's one person that's been left off this list that I actually thought was a favorite to win, and that's Evans Chebet. And neither of us really know why he's not on that list. To be clear, Evans Chebet, he's won a lot of majors in the last few years. He won Boston last year, I'm pretty sure. He's also won New York.
I forget if he's run, if he has he won two Bostons and a New York or two New Yorks and a Boston. One of those two situations.
Yeah. Either way, he's won a lot of majors. He's beaten Kipchoge. He's not on the list. I mean, we can go through the list quickly, and we want to make sure we're not talking to this whole segment for an hour or more. We easily could. But he's not on there, Evans Chebet. There's a whole lot of guys here that have run 203, 204 in the last year or two.
But not all performances, not all 203s, and not all major wins are considered equal. Boston and New York are the tactical championship hilly races of the six majors, right? And then even if you throw in the two races that aren't majors but should be, which is Valencia and Dubai, those are also still in the London, Berlin, Chicago, Tokyo flat fast model, right? Not the Boston, New York hilly championship model. So that's another thing, right? This is not the Paris Olympic marathon that's run in August is not going to run like the flat Berlin marathon that's run in late September in cooler temperatures, right? It's just a completely different race. For example, it was always going to be a question mark, even with Kelvin Kiptum, who had run 35 seconds faster than any other human ever, right? It was still a question mark as to, all right, you raise the temperature 30 degrees Fahrenheit and you go from a course that gains and loses 50, maybe 100 meters of elevation gain and loss over the course of a marathon to a course that's gaining and losing over 600 meters. It's just, we still didn't know how that guy is the best. It's still weird to say. He was, may he rest in peace, the fastest flat marathoner by a massive margin versus everyone else ever. But we still didn't know how he's going to do it in this race. So there's just so many additional question marks because it's a hilly championship, hot weather Olympic marathon.
Evans Chebet, just to bring him back up, a person that's not on this list. So in the meantime, while Max is sharing a very important point there, Evans Chebet won Valencia Marathon in 2020. He also won Lake Biwa in 2020. Lake Biwa was a pretty hard one to win, actually. That's in Japan. In 2021, he came fourth at London. And then since then, he's won Boston twice and New York once. This guy just wins all the big races, including the majors that are hard and tactical. It's just super strange he's not on this list. There's probably a reason that we're missing it. I actually floated the idea before recording this with you that maybe he doesn't want to go to the Olympics. That sounds hard to understand, but it's possible he has actually decided that he doesn't want to be on the team. That's unlikely. I'd say that's very unlikely.
Let's expand on that for a minute. So for people who don't know, basically in these East African countries, the emphasis is not on the Olympics. A lot of these runners are not growing up dreaming of glory. They're growing up dreaming of being able to build a financial future for their families, right? And the Olympics has no prize money. It theoretically has prize money that sort of come back in terms of sponsorships, contract bonuses, right? But there is no check waiting for you at the finish line. And there is a check waiting for you at the finish line of every other competitive marathon in the world, right? The other thing about it is that since it's in the summer, most of these athletes are usually running two marathons a year, one in the spring, one in the fall. If that, some athletes only run one. But if you go to the Olympic marathon in August, you run that all out, you're probably taking yourself out of being able to go to a different marathon in the fall and win some prize money. So for these East African athletes, a lot of the time, unless they're in a position where they can medal very confidently, they do not want to go. It sounds crazy to...
Especially an American. Because Americans, the Olympics more, is everything.
Is everything, right? But for us, we have to remember, running is not really a key... No one gets into running for the money in America. In Kenya, that's one of the main and only reasons, is because if you have a talent, you have the ability to provide for your family and better their lives immeasurably. So yeah, basically, if you are getting, if you're on the Kenyan Olympic marathon team and you're getting sent there, but you're third fastest behind your two teammates anyway, right? So worst case scenario, best case scenario, you're getting a bronze medal and probably someone else is going to beat you anyway, right? There's not a huge incentive for them. They don't, in fact, there's a significant lack of financial incentive. Those guys, their contracts do not get enhanced by making an Olympic team the way that in the US, like Dakota Lindworm just made her first Olympic team. And now all of a sudden she is going to get a massive endorsement deal from Puma, right? And that is going to change her life and change her career. Does not happen just from making the team in Kenya. Yeah, if you win a medal, possibly. But again, if all you're doing is just getting this participation medal for racing in the Olympic marathon, for a lot of guys from African nations, that's more of a loss than it is a win.
But there's something that
Evan Schmidt could win.
Exactly. He could win. We don't know why he's not on this list. We could quote a list, but it's half names you probably wouldn't have heard of. 202, 203, 204 guys. Jeffrey Campbell was on there. He's pretty well known, being Eliud Kipchoge's, I wouldn't say his main training partner, but at least he's one of the strongest training partners. He had the half marathon world record for a while. There's Amos Kipruto. He's run 203. There's a Tokyo Marathon winner from last weekend, Timothy Kiplagat. Obviously, Kiptum's still on there. Kipchoge's on there. Vincent Nagedich is on there. He ran 204, 18 at the Tokyo Marathon, came third. He came second behind Kipchoge at last year's Berlin Marathon, 203.13. How do you go about picking this team? Max, if you were in charge, I'm not going to ask you who you would pick necessarily, or you could answer that if you want to, but how would you look at picking it? What would your philosophy be here?
I think you have to look at history of races with hills and hot weather conditions. And you're not picking, and I think this is also bringing it back to sort of US relevance. A lot of people have expressed either appreciation for or a lack of appreciation for the US hosting their Olympic trials at a very hot weather marathon at the Orlando race this year. But it's not supposed to be who can run the fastest in a controlled condition. It is simply who, no, I won't say simply because it's very far from simple. It is who can run the best that marathon in those conditions, right? It is highly specific. And there are a lot of very good runners who can run very well on a flat course who cannot. There are also an unknown quantity of runners who can run well on a flat course who can also run well a hilly marathon, right? Specificity doesn't go in one direction. But when it's not measured, we don't really have an idea. So when I go through these results, all of these PBs come at flat courses, right? Because that's where PBs are set. PBs don't come from Boston. They don't come from New York. What I would do is I would dig into these guys' results and I would try and find, all right, let's look at every race that's been over 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Let's look at every race that's had more than 200 meters of gain and loss. Those are the things that I would try and focus on. And then I wouldn't try to extend out this list any more than it already is. But we see a lot of guys, especially places sort of 6 through 10, and we got this list off of Let's Run. I'm not entirely sure if this list was numbered in the way that we have been viewing it, where Eliud Kipchoge is at the top, Kelvin Kiptum is number second. Kelvin Kiptum is second. God. I need a little bit more pillar performance.
You need less pillar performance, my friend.
And then Titus Kipruto This guy has a 204 PB with no wins, is down there in 10th. But we have a lot of guys, Bernard Kohec, 204.09 win, Hamburg 2023. He's number six. Jeff Kenmore, 204.2023 win, London 2023. Cyprian Kota, 204.47 win in Hamburg 2022. Amos Caputo, 204.39 win in London 2022. So we have those four guys. They've all run 204 to win a marathon in the last 2 years. Basically exactly the same result, right? I would try and find, at least between those four, I try and find, again, I look at where the hot weather race is, how are they doing in the more hilly races as well, and then I try and re-rank that list. I do the same thing for the names above them. And with, we're not going to talk about Kipchoge for a second, and obviously Kipton when we go into the Olympics. We have Vincent Nigenich, Timothy Kepgott, Benson Kipruto. Those are numbers 3 through 5 on the list. Yeah. Now we're looking at a slightly different level from those other guys. We're looking at guys who have PRs of 2:03:13, 2:02:55, 2:02:16. Oddly enough, those PRs are actually in descending order, even though the 2:03 guy is number 3 on the list and the 2:02 low guy is number 5 on the list. But it is important to know, actually, both number 4 and number 5 have PBs that come from before this list. Sorry, they have come after this list is published. So actually, maybe probably just coincidence. But yeah, I do the same thing. I look at Vincent Nigenich, Timothy Kipgott, Benson Kipruto. I look at how are they doing in races that are just a little bit closer to the conditions that they're going to face in Paris. And then I re-rank my list. And yeah, a certain amount of flat potential for Kelvin Kipton, for example. If Kelvin Kipton was still with us, we'd say, all right, it doesn't matter that we don't know how this guy runs on a hilly course. He's running so much faster than anyone else ever has on a flat course. We're just going to take the risk that he sucks at the hills, right? He's so good on the flats and just in general as a marathon runner. We're not going to care that he's unproven on the hills because he's so good, right? But for a guy who is not hands down the best flat marathoner in the world, we have to look a little bit deeper at those other results.
Interesting. This is what I think that they should do. And I think this would only work for Kenya. They should tell these 10 men, and maybe they should even expand the list to 20. And they should say, okay, guys.
Just to make it interesting.
We have a 30K race 4 weeks before the Olympics. And all of you, if you get to the start line and finish in under 210 pace, you'll get $500. Because $500 to a Kenyan is a lot of money. And then the top three go. 4 weeks before,
you think,
30K.
Hold on. Do you think running an all-out 30K, it is in the summer, like 2 weeks, like a week or two before the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, you think that sounds, from an athlete's perspective, oh my gosh. You can't, like, we ripped, at least I ripped the Ethiopian Federation for doing something very similar in 2020, where unannounced on about 5 weeks' notice, they told athletes, if you want to make the Tokyo Olympic team from Ethiopia, you have to show up in Switzerland and run a 35K race on an abandoned airport tarmac. And if you don't come to this race and you don't race, you will not be considered. And okay. Everyone's just like, what the fuck?
I agree with you. That is not ideal. But I'm taking out a few elements that you're criticizing, which is very fair to criticize. I'm removing the fact that it's randomly 5 weeks before. Here we are. This is a planned thing with a date well in advance. I would
wait. Hold on. One quick question. If you were doing this, would you have made the date? I consider March, where it is today, is March 10th. I consider this to be way too late to announce that.
Yeah.
In your plan, you would have announced this like two years ago.
I probably would have announced it definitely last year at the latest in December. Absolutely.
I'm saying, like, you would have announced that it would have been a thing 2 years ago and you would have found a date for it by December.
Probably, yeah.
Okay. All right. So, okay.
I would also have the race.
Got that cleared up.
So I'd also have the race in Nairobi. Everyone can get to, especially when you're in Iten, you can get a bus there in 6 hours. And I would just make that race, the top three go. Just back to the old American way of doing top three of the trials.
No, I think it's great because I think that the idea that it's, why does it have to be 5 weeks before?
Because then that shows that they're going to pick three people that are in terrific form. And I think 4 or 5 weeks before a marathon, to do a 30K all out is a perfect training run for a marathon.
Okay. Question for you. If you had the power, would you change the US system to be a sub marathon distance closer to the actual Olympics as well?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Instead of the idea of it's a full marathon that's 4 to 5 months out.
Yeah. Maybe my idea is not a very good one, to be fair, because 30K is very different to a marathon. But if you can run a really fast 30K, there's a pretty damn good chance you're in good marathon shape. But when you ask that question, it actually makes me think maybe my idea is not very good.
In Paris, all the action is going to unfold in the middle 25K. The first, or actually is even less than that. I think it's the first 10 to 15K are dead flat, and the last 8 to 10K are also dead flat. So the middle chunk from 15 to 35K is where I think the race, it could be that the race is actually won in that last flat 10K, but the energy expenditure that will lead to the race being won or lost is guaranteed to happen on the hills in the middle, in that middle chunk.
Very true. Yeah, I don't know what Kenya Athletics are going to do here. Sorry, I keep calling them Athletics Kenya. We'll see. Time will tell. We'll no doubt touch about it on the podcast, but I think they'll pick Kipchoge. Come on, let's keep in mind, he won the last two Olympics. He's like second. If you look at the top 10 fastest times of all time, he's got a whole lot of them. It would be really harsh for him to not be on the team. Let's be fair. Double Olympic champ. I don't know.
Yeah, let's talk about potential upside, right? We know what his potential upside is. And that's
potential. Comfortably.
And yeah, it's possible that his upside is now lowered, but we simply have no way of knowing that. But if we are betting on Kipchoge, we're betting on the possibility that he wins the Olympics comfortably. There's no one else that we don't know he has that upside, but there's no one else who we can even be remotely confident has that upside either, right? He is the only one who has actually done that. If you're betting on anything, you're betting on, I think you make the right point. If you're betting on anything, you bet on that.
We shall see. We shall see. I think we'll hear more news, maybe not even the next few weeks, maybe by June or July. But I think given that you've got to go to a coaching call soon-ish, Max, we can move on to World Indoors. There were some pretty cool, interesting races to watch. What do you think? Let's start with your prediction of Josh Kerr and the 3K. Great race.
I said it last week. I said prior to the race, I said Josh Kerr is going to win on Saturday and he's going to win in Paris. Different event. But yeah, this is a man who is on top of the middle distance running world at the moment. I think that he wasn't dealt the hardest possible hand he could have been dealt here. I think that Barega and Wale, and I forget the name of the third Ethiopian who was in the race, but I know that he was much younger and less experienced than Barega and Wale. If they really wanted to try, if they really wanted to commit to trying to drop him, maybe the race would have been different. As it unfolded, their team tactics were super messy, right? We saw a slow first K, 2:38. I sent you a text right then. I said, this is playing just right into Josh's hands. He's winning it, right? You made the point too, like last week, Joshua's 8-flat world 2 mile record converts to a 7:24 3K. So if you're trying to have him run 7:24 pace, if that's what you squeeze the pace down to, which is again, that's 2:28 a K, right? They went out a full 10 seconds slower than that. You're probably not going to drop Josh going 2:28 a K. You have to go out too fast intentionally, right? Go out 2:25, 2:26 for the first K, to force Josh onto the back foot. And that's what they did not do. Now, that is a remarkably difficult thing. It doesn't matter if all three Ethiopians were completely united in the desire to do that and they'd executed it perfectly, it still might not have worked, nor they still might not have been able to do it, right? Even if they had the desire. But they clearly didn't have the desire, right? This is the problem with team tactics and running. If a guy is making the final, yes, this is a straight final, but if a guy or a girl is on the start line with a chance to win the race and their federation tells them to sacrifice themselves in order to push a hot pace, in order to take a kicker out of the race for one of their teammates, you're asking them to do something that they're physically and mentally not conditioned to do, right? Let's say Borrega, or let's say Wally, really wanted to push the pace for Borrega. There's still a large part of them that's, I can win this race. So why should I throw away my race? You have to put a lot of probably money on the line in order to really get team tactics to work, because otherwise it's just to the victor go the spoils, as we said with Magnus Sitlev, right? And the Ethiopians, I think, were maybe either too disorganized, or each one was thinking about their own race in order to even try and do that ambitious plan of taking it out in a pace that's like 7:15 3K pace, which is might be enough to drop Josh Kerr, but we didn't find out. Josh Kerr let the searches come and go, and he just played it perfectly. And I think after that first K, once we got a sense of Wale trying to surge, but it not working, I think we knew who the winner was going to be.
Josh Kerr just looks intimidating. I love that. And I think that there's something to that. I think the way he feels being intimidating, and then people around him feeling intimidating, I think I said this in the last episode of The Action. I'm just really enjoying this lead up to him versus Jakob, because they're just both so intimidating.
One of the other things, you're talking about what Josh Kerr looks like and what he feels. As a coach, what I see watching that race is I see how Josh Kerr looks really uncomfortable running 62-61 to 63 second pace per 400. Not because it's too fast, but because it is too slow. And I saw this a little bit at Millrose as well. Josh is just, he's a little bit overly bouncing. He's yapping at people's heels. And to me, that just says, this pace is so easy for this guy. It is absurd, right? That's where my mind goes. And I think when you see him in the race and you see him just floating, for a guy who's that speed-based, it's so difficult for him to just have to wait and bide his time the way he needs to in the 3K, even more differently than the 1500, right? Where even if the guys are biding their time, they're running 59 seconds a lap. Just shows to me that he's just in so much fitness, so much control, and so much confidence.
Yeah. That was a 3K. Nagus, your main man, American, second. I just say that because he's American.
I think it's Nagus. Do you want to say what you want to say about Nagus?
I have nothing to say.
Nagus, I think we're looking at a supreme talent, but a lot of people are talking about how Nagus did not run for the win. And yeah, he doesn't have the world championship experience prior to this. He has it, but he got fifth last year. He was unable to run the Tokyo Olympics because of injury. So he's just unfamiliar with the stage, but does he have the killer instinct? What a lot of people are talking about. I'm not sure I can say one way or another, but I think that the situation that we're in for him now is in the 1500 in Paris. I think a medal is almost guaranteed for him, but I think the win is going to be really hard, whether it's Jakob he has to beat, Kerr he has to beat, or maybe even Nordas.
Whiteman. Let's not forget about Whiteman. Just because he's been injured and he hasn't been racing his best, he's still going to be there and dangerous man. For sure.
But with Whiteman, it's like, for him, I don't think Jake Whiteman is a guy who we can reliably expect to get into 328, 329 fitness every year, right? I think there's a chance, I'm not saying I'm right about this. You know, obviously, there's a giant chance I could be wrong. Jake Whiteman, I don't think that 2022 was like, all right, this is what we can expect from Jake Whiteman. I think that was the best year of his career ever. And okay. I think that it was phenomenal. He earned that gold, and it was an amazing race to watch. But I don't think Jake Whiteman is going to be a guy who we see get into 328 shape for the world final in the 1500 every year the way these other guys are. They most definitely.
That's very fair enough. What do you think about the 1500?
I just want to say, shout out to Olin Hacker. Olin Hacker, if you don't know, is American who ran for the University of Wisconsin, won the NCAA 5K title last year, and went to NAZ Elite to be coached originally under Ben Rosario, and now they have a new coach whose name is completely slipping my mind. I know that he's young, and I know Olin said that the athletes had a significant input into hiring at NAZ Elite. former assistant at University of Portland, which is a pretty damn good cross-country program. But yeah, Olin Hacker took it to them with, I think, about 500 meters to go and just really threw his hat in the ring, wanted to see what he had. That's a killer instinct that I think we're looking to see from Yarny Goose, right? Yarny Goose knows he's super fit, knows he's one of the best guys in the world, knows he can run to a medal. But we want to see Yart risk it for the biscuit as Americans. Me speaking for Americans. Olin Hacker showed he's willing to risk it for the biscuit, still came home fifth. What a result. And I think that we've seen a lot of athletes in the U.S. who have gone to Northern Arizona Elite, maybe been a little bit overlooked as they start their pro careers, but good results come out of that program. And I'm really excited to see this. I think that what people outside of the U.S. don't really understand here, this result right here puts Olin Hacker immediately in the conversation for making the Olympic team in the 5K. That's going to be the subject of future podcasts for sure. One other thing on the 3K, really just, as I said, disappointing tactics from Brigan Wale. Kenda Wale has been the fastest guy on season best, personal best, and a lot of these World Indoor 3000s over the last a half dozen years, and he's never won. He's gotten second a couple times. This poor guy, he just can't. He's the opposite of Samuel Tefera, right? He just cannot put it together no matter what, whereas Tefera comes to indoors ready to play. So something else I want to talk to you about this 3000. Why is there a guy in here who was triple lapped by Josh Kerr, running 9:37 for 3000? We got a bunch of high school U.S. girls who could kick his ass. Why is he in this race? Why is he hugging the rail and forcing Josh Kerr to... I don't think Josh Kerr wanted to elbow this guy, but he's literally in the way.
Afghanistani, Muhammad Kareem Yakut, shout out, 9:37 for 3K. To be honest, I did notice him, but I didn't really think too much about it at the time, but you bring up a good point. Is there some sort of rule that, is there some sort of rule that you can enter one person in one event from every country? Because Afghanistan obviously is not entering a lot of runners.
Sure. Yeah. I'm just like, I get that he wants to have his best potential performance there, right? He's there. He feels like he wants to do he obviously wants to do the best that he can.
You're not even yet speaking to the question of like, how did he get there? How did he qualify?
No, I think you're right. I think that there's universe. I only know this because we're talking about the road to Paris and the Olympic marathon. If Leonard Carrier is going to end up getting a spot, there's this idea of universality places, which is that if countries have not hit any standard, they can place athletes for the Olympics. I believe it's the marathon, the 1500. So you can place an athlete in a marquee event. They get some TV time. They get out in the prelim or that in the marathon, they're just not on TV, right? I don't know how slow they're allowed to run. I think it's like, you know, you could have a 2:55 marathoner from Iraq or whatever. I think that they're allowed to get a place if that's the event that their country wants to play to pick for universality place. So I can see why he's there. But I'm just like, on an outdoor track, you have more room to move around. But on an outdoor track, lapped runners, I don't know if it's a rule or not, but they'll typically move to the outside. This guy just hugs the rail in the middle of a turn on a banked 50-meter turn. And I was like,
I'm not sure Muhammad really cares about Josh Kerr's win. That's my take.
I'm sure he didn't care. And it's not his responsibility to care. It's World Athletics' responsibility to care, right? In my opinion, World Athletics needs to be making if you're getting lapped three times in a 3K, you need to move out into lane three. Now, if someone's trying to make a move into lane three, then he is in the way more there. The way people will move is more outside than inside on an indoor track. Does he have to go out to lane six? Okay, I could see how this could get messy. But the idea that what if Josh Kerr had tripped over this guy? That just gets in my head. And I'm just like, that would be a massive load of shit. Can we just agree that is a possibility that we shouldn't? I don't know what the solution here is, but I didn't.
Are you clear? Because I have no idea. Are you clear that there is a rule that you're supposed to move out to the outside lanes?
Not in the slightest.
Okay. It's possible there's no rule. And so you actually adhere to the point that going out into the outside lane of two and three might actually be a worse idea. Because if there is a tactical affair at the end, then you're really in the way. Whereas if you hug the rail, you might be even less in the way. I don't know. Yeah,
I think you're in the way regardless, but I just think, I don't know. It ended up being fine. I'm probably just barking up a tree here. It is a good thing that underrepresented countries get to put athletes at these championships.
Is it though? Sort of, I think,
yes.
I don't know. I'm all for having a world champs or Olympics for lots of countries, but I'm not quite sure if random, I don't want to call him random. He's a runner that trains, but he isn't anywhere near these other people. Is that deserving to be in the, I don't know. I'm not sure.
That's the problem with the straight final. I think the idea that you get a couple places to throw in, we talked about the spirit of sport, right? The spirit of sport means that I was talking to a buddy the other day and he's like, if I was from Turks and Caicos, I would have been a two-time Olympian in the 200 meter breaststroke in the pool, right? And like, That's a fact, right? I know that if I was from Brazil in 2015, I would have been on the world championship team for cycling, right? Like it just is. I had some friends who were on the Brazilian world championship team who I was beating consistently in races. But I was a massive cry away from making the team for the United States. Yeah, I think that, you know, we think about the message of sport and the message of the Olympic movement. And I think that it is important, but it is annoying that it could jeopardize a world final. I think that I'd want to see a solution where countries can get some representation, but there's zero chance that it comes at the cost of the athletes who are winning medals.
Yep.
And here it was a risk.
Very true. I think we can speak more to the 1500 meters for a little while. I thought this was a brilliant race. Jordi Beamish coming from behind like he did and winning. Funnily enough, I actually got told that Beamish won before I watched it. And then I watched it. And with a lap to go, I was like, there's no way he wins. I mean, he's eighth and he looks like he's struggling. And that's 200 meters. Around an outdoor track, that's very close to the end. But he comes through, wins, takes down some really fast finishes. Here's the thing.
So yeah. I was watching this with my housemate, who, oddly enough, his former roommate was Jordi Beamish. And my housemate's name is Steve Jones, former steeplechaser for Mississippi State and Colorado University, or University of Colorado. And I'm watching this race. I'm watching this about 150 meters ago. I'm like, Cole's got it. Like, Cole is, he's clear of what looked to be everyone who could have a kick that potentially challenges him. And before Beamish is even in the frame, Steve's just watch for Jordi, just wait for Jordi. And then with 60 meters to go, it still looks like Cole is clear of almost everyone, but Jordi just comes out of nowhere flying by. And the top speed was never in question. This kick was nuts. And I think that for maybe a lot of people who listen to this podcast, probably listen to a lot of other podcasts, and they've heard the same comments being made for the last week. Jordi's kick is insane. I think what we talk about is like, this still was a 3:36 race, and I'm not trashing on Jordi. Jordi is a world champion. I think he proved a lot of people wrong here. I think he proved that, he said after the race, he thinks him and Cole have some of the best last 150s in the world. I think you can make the claim that Jordi has the best last 150 in the world. But I think this is less, oh, could he possibly do something in the 1500? And it's more, all right, this is proof that he's a serious medal threat in the steeplechase. Coach Mike Smith, where Jordi went to school, likes to tell his athletes to go to sleep, but shut their mind off in the middle of the race and just let things run on autopilot before waking back up to sort of race near the conclusion of the race. And Jordi just takes that a little bit too much to heart sometimes, right? It's not that he isn't strong enough to be in these races. It's not that he doesn't have the kick that can take him back to the win, but if you're in eighth with too much to go at the world final outdoors in the 1500, you are not winning. Like, it's just, and it's weird because sometimes indoor track is tougher to move up. Sometimes it's easier to move up. And I'm saying most of the time it's tougher to move up, but I'm saying you put them on an outdoor track, it's not going to work. But the reason why is because that outdoor final is going to go 3:28, right? It might not go 3:28, but it's going to go under 3:30. And when you're kicking off of a 3:30 pace, you can't be that far back, right? Because it's not as much about a sudden change of gears. Now we're kicking. It's more building up to the kick, right? In these last few global finals in the men's 1500, it looks very different from what global finals used to look like, where there is a moment where all of a sudden the gear gets kicked and everyone's kicking. Now, pace just gets hot, hotter, hottest, and then you kick, right? So you have guys who are running 25, 26 seconds for the last 200, but they're running off of 328 pace or 330 pace, kicking down to a 329 or 328, right? They're not running before the last 200 of this race. They're running like 340 pace almost, right? Yeah. If Jordy's last 200 was 26 flat, he ran 336. So even if he ran pace, that would have been 340, right? If he ran average pace for the last 200 of the whole race, it would have been 340. So squeezing it down from a 340 to a 336, that's not what happens. It gets squeezed down from a 330 to a 328. And I think that the dynamics of that are just very different.
Mm. But it begs the question of, if no one pushes the pace at the start of the Paris Olympics final and everyone just dawdles and Ingebrigtsen decides to go for it with 600 meters, 400 meters to go, which he probably won't. But if he does,
I think that you make a totally valid point. It could be that Jakob does not do that, right? But I think if Jakob doesn't do it, somebody else is going to. I think that you have. I don't see a world where Narv Nordås lets Jakob take. If Jakob signals to the field that he wants it to go slow, if nothing else, Narv Nordås is going to make it fast, because Narv Nordås wants to kill Jakob.
Speaking of Nordås, he was fifth, Cole Hocker second, Hobbs Kessler third. America goes 2-3. Very promising for the American milers. Cole Hocker, yeah, I spoke to him the other day in person where he lives in Blacksburg, was very happy with the result. Obviously wanted to win. He has his sights firmly set on trying to win the Olympics. He was very humble about saying that to me, but that's what he wants to do, which is obvious. And he's a solid champion. There's just so many guys that could win that race. But hey, Max, we got to get moving. Let's talk about some of the women's races. Ellie St. Pierre, what do you think?
I think she's in an interesting spot. I think that if the flat 3K was an Olympic event, I think we should almost hand her the gold medal now. Almost. I think maybe Faith Kipyegon would have something to say about that. So maybe I walk that back immediately as it comes out of my mouth, but she's in an interesting spot theoretically, right? Theoretically, the 1500 and the 5K are too fast. 1500 is too pure speed fast, right? It's, you got Faith Kipyegon running 349 on the 5K side. It's a strength that even running 820, it's going to be really tough. I think we have, with the number of women we have right now under 1410, it's going to take another jump. Like the jump that it took Ellie St. Pierre to make to come up to this fitness, right? It's going to take another equal jump to be in 1400's shape. I'm in the 5K, right? And this jump did not come easy and is pretty unprecedented. To make another equal jump would just be nuts. But on the upside, she beat Gudov Sagai as a woman who we thought was completely unbeatable in the 3K or the 5K, because she's a 353 woman in the 1500, and she ran 14 flat for the 5K. Pre-classic last year. So you put those two tools together in a 3K and you're just like, how can this woman lose unless she's just completely not on her game? And she still ran it. That Sagai still ran 820 as well, right? It's not, you can't say Sagai's off her game, but it's massive that St. Pierre was able to beat her. And I think that for women around the world who are looking at this sort of big four, Faith Kipyegon, Gudov Sagai, Stefan Hassan, and Letessa Megide, looking at these big four, like these, theoretically, these four runners could sweep the medals between the four of them in the 1500, the 5K, and the 10K. For Sagai to go down like that, I think is probably, there are a lot of women around the world who probably have a lot of hope now, because it's like, it's a big scalp to nab. And I think it reveals that someone who previously we thought was unbeatable might have chinks in her armor. And a massive amount of kudos to Ellie St. Pierre for exposing them.
Mm. So she takes the win in a pretty strong field. Jessica Hull was 4 seconds back, so she's in serious shape. Women's 1500 meters, just quickly, Nikki Hiltz from the US came second. Ethiopia had the win, 4-1. Halu, I actually wasn't familiar with the name. A lot of these names just pop up here and there.
There are three Ethiopian girls who have all run 353, 354, last quad, and they're all really young.
Right.
They're all teenagers, I think. So just massive amount of talent. But they that's another thing we can talk about. We're running out of time here, but the team tactics in this 1500 between those three Ethiopian athletes was pretty abysmal. I think that they could have, if they were smarter, I think they could have swept this field, but they just were not.
I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't actually trying to work together. Who knows? You never know with the Kenyans and Ethiopians. Sometimes they look like they are, but they're really not. They're just deciding in the moment to work together. You'd be surprised at how Ethiopia and Kenya are just so full of insane talent, but you'd be surprised how little intelligence and thought goes into how they race. It's usually just a case of get in there and try and win. But who knows? In this particular case, they might have been working together, but they did end up first, fifth, and eighth. And yeah, I actually wasn't super familiar with Emily McKay, who came third, American, 402.
A lot of Americans, I think, were not. Yeah, she runs for Mark Coogan, New Balance Boston. Yeah, pretty massive win for her. I think she had a pretty significant performance getting, she got second to Nikki, USA's indoors several weeks ago. And yeah, she's a serious threat to, Makai said before the race that she felt she could run 3:59. We extrapolate that out to June where the US Olympic trials will happen. I think this performance, I think that the women's 1500 at this meet has much less ramifications on the Olympic final of the same distance. And it more has to do with who will be in that race, who will make the team. I think that it cements Nikki Holtz as the favorite for the US 1500. And I think that it puts Emily McKay in significant conversation to make that team as well. And then we'll see what happens when the full field's back together in Paris.
That's a little recap on the distance running. We didn't really go too much we didn't talk about the 800 too much at all, but that was the sort of 15 and 3K. To round this one up, Max, London Marathon entries came out pretty big, especially the women's. There are three of the fastest four women in history running the race, including the world record holder, 2:11 female from Ethiopia. But what's interesting is they've announced that they're going for the women's only world record of 2:17. Which is interesting, given that she ran 2:11 last year.
So is this a veiled world record attempt or is it not?
From reading the article on the London Marathon website, which anyone can find by just typing into Google, women's London Marathon fit start list, is there's very clear communication from the meet director at London Marathon that they're going after the women's only world record, which is great. That's well, do you care about the women's only world record? I guess it's a thing, but.
No,
I don't.
I think that what we're looking at right now is like the biggest implications of this race, I think, are Asafa's form pre-Paris. I think we'll probably have a sense, hopefully have a sense from this race. Is she in a position to build upon? Building upon it. Is she in remotely the same fitness as she was in Berlin? Because if she is, like how we were talking about with the Kenyan men, when the best flat runner in the world is by far the best flat runner in the world, you have to think, all right, even if you throw some hills and some heat at them, they've still got to be a pretty heavy favorite. If Asafa shows that she's in anything like the form that she showed in Berlin, then it's going to be a significant, not necessarily watch on a world record at this race, but significant watch for her to win in Paris. Along with the other athletes, just checking in with them, the Olympic year. So people are paying attention to results. People are reading into what does this mean for the summer, Matt and I included. So I think it'll be really interesting. We got Mark Scott debuting there from the UK.
Kenenisa Bekele.
Journey in the sport. What?
Kenenisa Bekele's in the men's race.
Yeah, it's remarkable that we didn't talk about it. This is 5 years ago. All we'd be talking about is Kenenisa Bekele topping a marathon. Yeah, I think that about does it for this week. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Let's talk more about the London Marathon as it gets closer as well. We're going to learn more about, there'll be more people added to the fields. It's in 5.5 weeks, but even still, I'm pretty keen to learn more about the Keeley's build up, if he posts anything at all about it. But also, NCAA's happened literally this same day that we're recording, so we might talk a little bit about that next week. But thanks for joining, Max. You're going to duck off for a coaching call soon. But thanks, everyone, for listening in. And we will speak to you all next week.